Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. We are glad that you're here with us, wherever you're from, and we hope that you're doing well today. Our website is redeyescreations.com, where you can find a lot more of what we do. Tons of shows available on a wide variety of topics related to our past, present, and future. We only have about 12 days left now until we'll be in San Mateo for the Secret Space Program Conference. I hope to see you there and that you'll be able to join us for the most exciting conference this year. And the website is secretspaceprogram.org. We'll be talking about this a bit as well today with our guest John Rappaport, who is one of the speakers at the event. John Rappaport is an investigative journalist, author, and publisher of the website nomorefakenews.com. He has worked as an investigative reporter for 30 years, writing articles on politics, medicine, and health. And although his main focus over the years have been on the power of imagination and creativity, he's most often cited and interviewed on conspiracies and global elites. We are going to continue our discussion on the recent unfoldment of the Edward Snowden saga today and put all of the recent developments of this story into the surveillance agenda, the agenda of self-censorship, internet freedoms, and much more. Important stuff ahead. Stay with us. And welcome back, John. It's great to have you back again so soon. Thank you for coming back. It's wonderful to have you here. Hope you had a good day so far.
Yes, it's great to be here always with you, and looking forward to this.
Me too. I think that we're going to have a great time, by the way, at the conference later this month as well, John, and you're going to be there together with a lot of other good speakers, and it's going to be really interesting. I want to ask you a little bit more about that later. I want to kind of see what angle you're going to cover as well, because I think that you bring a really good perspective and kind of a different flavor to things as well, which is going to make the conference a little bit different. So I'm really looking forward to that. But we can talk more about that later. One of the topics we obviously wanted to focus today on is the Snowden situation, which basically has escalated, if you will, since we talked about this, over probably 6 months ago now, if not more. And we talked about the surveillance state. We talked about how he was brought into the mix. We questioned his background or whatnot. How has this research since that time unfolded, John, and how do you view this today? Is there any different than when we talked about this last time?
Well, my questions about his background certainly remain the same, but intensified, because now, in his recent interview with Brian Williams of NBC, he suddenly said, "I'm not an analyst, I'm a trained spy." And then he went on to say that he was not only a trained spy for NSA, but also CIA and DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. And he doubled down on that by stating that he had worked in several places under assumed names and given job titles that were really cover stories for jobs, as he put it, that he didn't have. Now, to me, that was a bombshell. And as usual, the major media did not follow up on this. Brian Williams did not. Nobody else really picked up on it, except to mention it as a sort of a headline the following day after the interview. But I mean, one would think that Brian Williams or any half-awake reporter would suddenly change directions and say, "I want to know about this. What are you talking about here?"
Yeah.
Specifically, what does this mean? Because now we're getting a completely, or most people at least, are getting a completely different picture of this guy. We know that he was in Geneva in 2009 working for the CIA, and that he was under diplomatic cover, pretending to be a diplomat, while in fact he was actually doing systems analysis, systems security for the CIA in Geneva. But what about these other jobs? What were they? He said they were all in foreign countries. What specifically was he doing for these agencies? I mean, you've got to ask these questions. because now, as I wrote recently, as a reporter, some people are going to say, well, who cares? We don't care who he is. We only care that he did a good thing,
right?
That he exposed these documents and so forth. But as a reporter, I say, no, you've got to go further because you never know where a story is going to lead you. And when you get to the bottom of it, which is the whole purpose, then you may find out things that you never expected to see. So his background becomes tremendously important after he made that statement. So I have to ask myself, why the resounding silence from Brian Williams and from the rest of the mainstream? Why didn't they immediately at least bring up the fact that we have to know more about this and begin questioning their sources as to who this guy actually is and what he was doing?
Yeah, definitely. Now, why? What I'm always curious about is to know why the why they drop these things themselves, though. Why they hand why the giveaway? You know, as you can help to ask, like, okay, is this something he's saying to try to seek credibility? That okay, I know what I'm doing because I have been this and that. In the official world, sure, that might be the case, right? But if we look at anything that has to do with the alternative and where the focus and the tension is, so people who really know stuff, this is the thing that actually is going to more and more discredit this gentleman, correct?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. You're right. It seemed like on the surface he was saying, I'm telling you this about myself because people in the NSA have said, quote, I don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about the extent of their spying, but you see, I really do because I'm a spy.
Right.
But really, I mean, why didn't he talk about this before? Why did he wait for that moment to bring it up? Does Glenn Greenwald know, or Laura Poitras, or the Washington Post, the New York Times, do they know that Snowden was actually a spy? Have they known all along and kept their mouths shut? What's going on here? I mean, this is a deep hole suddenly that's been opened up. And it's very important not to just, suddenly cover it up and say, well, we don't care, because the main point is this guy exposed documents. The other thing that Snowden has kept on saying is public debate. That's the whole idea. I wanted to open up public debate. And so in this recent article that I wrote about him, I said, well, how is that going? Are we really having a public debate?
Right.
What debate? Has the power of the NSA been limited in any significant way since these revelations about the documents? I don't see it. In fact, as far as I can tell and estimate, their power has actually increased because now they can bury some of their work much, much deeper, knowing what the risk of exposure has been, their exposure. They can begin to initiate other programs, and they apparently have a stranglehold on the Congress of the United States, which leads us to assume that Congress has certainly been spied on by NSA, and that they are open to blackmail.
Well, it's just very bizarre, this whole thing, in terms of why they've said certain things and in the way that they've released things. In your view, why is it important to kind of deconstruct a little bit more of who he has been, right? Let's just assume for a moment then that, okay, this is, he was in this world, he used to be a spy, he used to work for the NSA, but now he has a change of heart, right? And he's he's doing the right thing for America, or the American people, I should say, right? So he should therefore be celebrated a hero. What would you say to that?
I would say, first of all, we don't know what we would find out if we can probe more deeply into who he is. As I had written some time ago, there is a significant chance that he never left the CIA. And if so, he might have been recruited, either knowingly, unknowingly, lied to by his own people, whatever, to make some sort of move against the NSA, because there's been a turf war for a very long time between those two agencies over budget money, over who is really going to control the gathering of intelligence, who has the upper hand in the world of intelligence gathering. These are important things. And a couple of scenarios that I painted, one was that sometime in Geneva, a few guys from the CIA approached him and said, you know, the NSA is going too far. They're threatening the very existence of American democracy, et cetera, as we know it, because they're spying on everybody all the time. And we have a plan to expose them, and we're looking for a guy that we think could be credible and would go a long way toward limiting their power. Are you potentially interested as a patriot in this kind of an operation? So it could have happened that way, cynically, on the part of several CIA people acting on behalf of the agency. Or these few CIA people could have been genuine patriots, who knows?
Right.
And they themselves could have been the ones who, over a long period of time, people in the CIA, penetrated the NSA and got a hold of these documents and gave them to Snowden. That is, he didn't really steal them himself at all, because he wasn't able to, because contrary to what I find to be quite incredible, that the NSA all along has had really poor internal security on their own methods, operations, and data, they've had very good security. And he was not able to crack it, but the CIA was. And they accumulated these documents and gave them to him with a cover story that he was this computer genius who stole the farm. Now, once we get into deep waters like this, we're looking at motive, we're looking at interagency warfare, we're looking at who knows where the rabbit hole goes. People who are content to say, well, it doesn't matter, he did a good thing no matter what his motives were, don't really understand how a story develops when you investigate it. In my 30 years of working as a reporter, I can't count the times when I started to look at something, thought to me, okay, this is it. This is the bottom. This is what the story is really about. Only to discover much later through, you know, continued digging that it wasn't that kind of a story at all. It turned into something else completely.
Yeah.
And if I had stopped, I would never have discovered that. And what I eventually did discover became far more important than the initial revelations. So we don't know where it would lead. We absolutely don't, but it's, in my view, imperative to try to find out. I'll give you one example, and that is the following. The surveillance state works because people know they're being spied on. That's the basic requirement for a surveillance state. People have to understand that they're being spied on 24/7 so that they police themselves.
Right.
Because you can't arrest everybody who has a stray thought or speaks a stray word or does something that's a little bit out of bounds. There just isn't the manpower and the money to do that kind of, you know, policing. What you do, though, is that you put fear into people so that they begin to tailor their thoughts, their words, their actions, which has been happening in America for quite some time now. So the revelations that Snowden has brought have absolutely added to that self-policing by Americans. It's like saying, here, folks, this is what we're doing, and now go for it. You want to take a chance, or do you want to police yourselves? And the majority of people are going to police themselves. So in that sense, the revelations add to the power of the surveillance state. Well, suppose that when we get to the bottom of this rabbit hole, it turns out maybe that that was the motivation all along in bringing these, quote, revelations to light.
Well, people they have to ask themselves, why is it that the media have been, just be honest, they've been all over this story like none other. There's certainly, we talked about this the last time, but I think it's a very important point to reemphasize. They've certainly done their best in the past to deny, if you will, attention to certain whistleblowers, and they've certainly been, high up there on the level. They've been people who were, credible. They've been inside of the industry, the field of these kinds of agencies, etc. But in this one, it's someone that they've put tremendous focus on. And so that's very interesting. That's very telling to me. I mean, they want us to know that we are being spied on, just as you said. Even we looked at an article just a couple of days ago about how Facebook allegedly are analyzing actually that when you compose a message on Facebook, they analyze how you change the message before you post it as well. They monitor when you type in the message, and then they analyze, okay, what words did you change? How did you change it? In other words, they're actually interested in the self-censorship for some very peculiar and interesting reason. I think that this story plays right in line with this type of thinking and the whole online world overall, as you say, John. I think it's about, we need to know that we are being constantly watched and monitored. And if that's the case, they certainly have to publish that to the people, right?
You bet. You bet. Take a guy like Russ Tice, who used to work for NSA. I mean, from what I can gather from his statements, especially recent ones, about NSA spying on many, many lawyers, on congressmen, and so forth, he alleges that there is a much higher level of secret data in the NSA that Snowden was possibly not even aware of, but certainly didn't get to tap into. He made this statement recently. Well, where are the reporters like Brian Williams from the mainstream rushing to Russ Tice to interview him extensively and in great detail to get exactly what he knows?
Yeah.
Where is that? Nowhere. That's not happening. Are they going after James Bamford for increasing interviews? Bamford has written two books on the NSA. He's the guy who is not a spy, who knows more about the NSA than probably anybody in the world. Is anybody rushing to him for extensive interviews? Are reporters beating at his door because now that some of this material is out in the open about the NSA, they want to know more and more and more? Of course not. They're not going anywhere near these guys. They're avoiding them studiously. Russ Tice had a much more significant position in the NSA than Snowden did, and knows a great deal more. So I think you're absolutely on the right track there. Snowden has been promoted. He has been made into, here is the great hero, or here is the great villain, depending on which way you want to play the story. And it's as if nobody ever knew anything before about the NSA until Snowden released it, until it became an incredibly major story. So, yes, absolutely. And as far as the business with Facebook goes and other programs, the NSA, the surveillance state, they want to be able to profile how well the knowledge that we are being spied on 24/7 is affecting our actions and thoughts. They want to know how well it's succeeding and in what ways is it succeeding. Oh, well, look what he corrected on his Facebook page. He was about to write this and that, looks like, and then he did this. Okay, so now let's put that together with, 5 million other pieces of data that we have about other people on Facebook and other activities, online activities, and let's begin to develop some kind of an algorithm that allows us to conclude to what degree and in what ways are we, the surveillance state, being successful? And how can we improve those ways in which we're not being successful to get people to police themselves more thoroughly, to crush dissent in that way? They are very, very interested in that.
Well, they are. You wrote recently as well a bit on political correctness, tie in with the surveillance state. Let's get into that a little bit later, but let's carry on and talk a little more about how some people have been coming out to claim that, you know, Snowden is a traitor as well. I think that this is very beneficial to the type of kind of movie screenplay, kind of coordinated media relations that we've seen when it comes to this particular scenario. And I'm not saying that there might be a huge, massive conspiracy by every single media, you know, outlet out there in that regard. But if some people do it or encourage it in a certain way, it tends to pick up and it goes, you know, hate to use the word, but it goes viral, as they say. And it, to me, it seems that this idea that he's kind of a perfect candidate for controlled opposition in this regard. We have people like, you know, John Boehner, more recently Mark Andreessen, I guess his name is, from the, he's a Facebook board member, actually, but he was founder of Netscape, among other things. He was also out recently talking about how Snowden was like a quote, textbook traitor, unquote. You know, these kinds of things feels to me that it's, it only furthers this kind of the polarization, the dichotomy as well, that you really want to pull this subject apart. I think there's been deep psychological studies on this, that if you set up, you know, really strong opposition to something, those who are on the other opposite side of that page tend to actually, without any level of criticism, support their hero, right? Because they feel that this is so important and it justifies their cause. So I'm just seeing this kind of psychological tug and pull kind of game behind Snowden, John.
You bet. It's establishing the narrative, something which the CIA, for example, has been very adroit at for decades. They do a great deal of research, starting in the old days with Operation Mockingbird, which was an attempt successfully to control the press, to have people on board in the press as their agents, in a sense. That also involves tailoring stories, establishing narrative. Okay, this is the narrative that we're going to explore. This is the narrative we're going to present. Hero or villain? Villain or hero? Let's bounce back and forth between these two. And sure, some of that is now damage control vis-a-vis Snowden, but it goes, as you say, psychologically deeper than that. Because once you involve people in that argument, that really becomes the primary focus. And it takes focus away from, well, in this case, the documents that Snowden has revealed, what they mean about the NSA and certain mega corporations, what else there is to discover about all of this. It's damage control, but it also is the tried and true way to guide public perception, public debate. If you want to debate, that's what the debate is about, public arguments, public thinking. Hero, villain, hero, villain. And you see, when you finally get down to what that narrative means, it means nothing. It just means, you know, it's kind of like you watched a football game on television and some guy who is considered to be a very good football player ran away from a play, and in doing so, he kicked somebody in the face on the other team who was lying on the ground. Well, let's look at the video. Let's look at it again and again and again. Did he do it on purpose or was it an accident? We know he's been guilty of this kind of thing before. Is this it again? Should we have a new rule? Should he have been kicked out of the game? Should he have been fined, suspended? And on this goes. And what does it ultimately mean? Nothing. And the CIA and other psychologists who work for these entities like the CIA and certain think tanks They know this. They're psychological warfare experts. In fact, after World War II, the psychological warfare experts who emerged went into the civilian sector and began to construct a whole new academic discipline called mass communications research, which really did not exist before in universities to any great degree. They created it out of thin air as if it were a science, and they gave themselves cushy jobs, and they continued to do their research. And all of that research is really about establishing narratives and stereotypes and guiding public perception with the objective to, one is getting people to see reality and think about reality in the way that you want them to, and equally important, getting stories to dead end into alleys that go nowhere. A lot of sound and fury that ultimately signify nothing, because that allows you to control public discourse. You get people's adrenaline all worked up, and eventually you realize, whatever happened to that? That was 3 years ago. I don't remember. What was the conclusion about that story? Well, there was no conclusion, because it was never meant to be a conclusion.
Yeah, it's funny how that just rolls on. And, you know, a couple of other items there too. For example, recently he was not admitted to the Stockholm Internet Forum. WikiLeaks came out and, you know, slammed them from that. And I just, you know, again, I'm not saying that there isn't a sincere, to a certain extent, maybe a sincere kind of opposition or political sensitivity here. For example, in Sweden, we know that, our foreign minister there, Carl Bildt, has been, you know, known Bilderberger. He's been, you know, kind of part of this circus a little bit as well, and that he might have some influence in this regard. But nonetheless, the way that just this idea that when there is an exclusion like this, when there's a clear cut kind of, censorship in that regard, really, this just, you know, garners more, energy, more momentum for those who are pro, you know, Snowden in this regard. And so have you seen this in other scenarios as well being used in this way? I mean, you're talking about that this is a known tactic. I want to try to make people understand that idea as well, that it's, I mean, for a moment we have to, whether we think he's good or not, right, we have to try to be objective and set that to the side to honestly try to look into him and see what is going on here, what is the bigger picture here. And sure, after that you can, you know, take a side or whatever if people feel that they need to do that. But I guess it, to me, it's designed to cloud the issue, as you said. It's designed to cloud your judgment, right?
Yes, very much so. Take in the last couple of years, the case of Russia. You know, Russia as a subject in the press was fairly dormant up until that time. Okay, there was the Cold War, and we had that, now that's over, and, well, you know, we're sort of establishing relations, we in the United States, and things are all right, that's a period of history, and then all of a sudden it gets ramped up again. Now, wait a minute, Snowden ended up in Russia, for one thing. And now we have Putin making all kinds of militant noises in Russia. And then all of a sudden there's the Ukraine and there's this and there's that. Are we starting the Cold War again? Is this beginning all over the place? And Russia is now threatening, in certain ways to go off the dollar. And they're talking with China. And, you know, here's a whole narrative that has been building for some time. A story. Hero, villain. Good guy, bad guy. Do we consider them on the same page as the United States or not? What is going on there? You know, their handling of Islamic terrorists within their own kind of purview. Is that good? Is that bad? Et cetera, et cetera. On and on this goes. Well, yeah. The real story has to do with globalism. The real story has to do with establishing, as some people like to call it, a new world order, establishing a global management system for the entire planet, something like the European Union, where national sovereignty and boundaries and so forth are eradicated, ultimately. And we have one planet under one rule, which many of us have been, you know, exposing and talking about for a very long time. That's the story. How is that going? Are there setbacks? What are the setbacks? Is it proceeding apace? Is it coming to greater fruition faster than we thought it would? Where are we on the timetable? What can we do about it? Meanwhile, the story about Russia and U.S. and Kerry making statements and Putin laughing at Obama, and yes, they recently had a photo op, but they didn't talk to each other. Oh, yes, they did talk to each other extensively. Well, wait a minute, it was only 10 minutes. You know, this is the soap opera. The soap opera version of reality, and people can then get on either side. Well, we never should have ended the Cold War. These guys are the bad guys. They've been the bad guys all along. No, they're not. They've been cooperative, etc. And as long as the public is focused only to that level, they will never see that there is a bigger issue going on, which is through globalism, economic, political, medical, etc., the push to involve all nations of the planet, including Russia and China, and to enmesh them deeper and deeper in this one world management system. That's the story. And it's not being told at all in the press, never is. Instead, we look at these little flare-ups and so forth between the U.S. government and Russian government and, you know, play soap opera with it. Hero, villain, on and on, same kind of thing.
Well, exactly. And I think it's interesting that, do you think that Russia then, especially considering the Snowden, are they just kind of, to a certain extent, are they smart in playing ball on this and thinking, okay, we can actually use this as a temporary measure to criticize, let's say, the West with the U.S. specifically in mind in terms of their surveillance state? Or is Russia, in your view, as much part of it towards globalism as any other country? Or do they represent any kind of opposition to this?
I think to some degree they represent opposition, as does China. But this is, as I said a minute ago, this is the story. The economic ties between China, for example, and the rest of the world, if you were to go back 50 years and compare what's happened, because globalists do take the long view, you're going to see that China is far more enmeshed in the global economic system and financial system. I mean, it's the difference between night and day if you go back 50 years.
Oh, yeah. And they wouldn't have been where they were if it wasn't for the globalist elite from the West, right?
Yes, and you can, that's right. And you can say the same thing about Russia. I mean, go back to the work of Anthony Sutton, technology transfers from the U.S. to the Soviet Union, and you see what has been going on through globalist manipulation to actually bring other nations into the same technological fold, knowing that ultimately, in the long run, this would help to spread globalism. Whereas if you have a different kind of looking world, it's not as easy. So this has been going on for a very long time. Also, I have to say that I'm sure that Russia has made every effort to find out exactly what Snowden knows and doesn't know.
Right.
Through whatever means they feel are appropriate. And their electronic spying, while it may not be on the level of NSA, is not as primitive as some people would like to think. So where are the famed Snowden laptops that he was supposedly lugging around with him in Hong Kong? Did he take them to China? Did he not? We've heard many stories about where all this data is being stored now. And what about Snowden himself? He is now guest of Russia. He is, according to some stories, almost out of money, doesn't have any money. He's living fairly well. He's talking to people in Russia. He's talking to Russian leaders. They're sitting around having dinner and so on and so forth. Do you think they're not profiling him? Do you think they're not trying to find out information that he knows in every possible way that they can. Of course they are. We're not getting any word about this. We're not hearing about it, but certainly they're involved. Russia, China, everybody is involved in surveillance state, you know.
Yeah.
And they're cooperating in some respects and competing in others. But the whole idea is that virtually all the world's leaders are on the same page when it comes to surveillance. They don't trust their own populations. They feel they need a leg up. They want to remain in control. They consider ordinary human beings like wild animals who are unpredictable and a distinct threat at any given moment. They want to curtail the thoughts, actions, perceptions of the mass of population. So in that sense, they're all already in agreement, you see.
Well, exactly. Again, think about this. I mean, what they have at their fingertips is something that no leader has ever had in history, as far as we know, in terms of what they could actually accomplish with all the data that they might gather, analysis, data accumulation, statistics on behavior, on you know, population patterns. They could even do experiments like they have with social media, right? You launch certain ideas to see what the response is on it, to predict. You run the algorithms in supercomputers to be able to, I mean, this is something, I think it's their wet dream. You know, this is something that could change the whole behavioral pattern of the human species if they wanted to use it in that way. And I think that that's what they're aspiring to. That's why, as you say, even if they have a different slant on it, even if they in their own minds consider it to be, you know, benign or whatever, they are at a cusp where they might be able to achieve something which they've never ever had before, which is about, ultimately, I think, in a way, it's about understanding people through statistics and analysis, and in that way being able to predict and in the future even steer that behavior.
You see, for example, in Common Core, which is the, you know, the new brightest, shiniest penny in public education in America, the one program across America, Leave No Child Behind, Head Start, Common Core, blah, blah, blah. They are now getting ready to monitor every child all the way through school. They're doing it to some degree now, but they're going to be doing it in much more profound ways as time moves on here. I'm talking about biomonitoring, for example, where the child's responses during classroom are measured electronically for biological indicators. We're talking about, of course, surveillance in the classroom. We're talking about monitoring keystrokes on computer. Anything that can be done will be done.
Yeah.
Because as you say, and your point is vital, these leaders look at the rest of the species as something that can be arithmetically calculated. They have the means to do this at increasingly sophisticated levels, as long as people behave within certain parameters. And that's the key to understanding the relationship between control and surveillance. The surveillance, one of its objectives, as I said earlier, is to get people to tailor their own behavior. And that helps when it comes to statistically representing human behavior, because now you're working with something less than human, really, because people are acting in more predictable ways across a smaller spectrum of thought, imagination, action.
Yeah.
All of this works hand in glove. All of it is self-fulfilling prophecy. All of it is, we want to profile humans as stimulus response biological machines and thereby control them. Well, human beings are not simply stimulus response biological machines. But if you can get them to behave that way on their own, increasingly, which is happening around the world, then it becomes easier to profile them, feed the data into algorithms, and control all humans on the planet. And that's exactly what it is that they're doing. And that's why when you talk about the spiritual component of an individual human being, or you talk about individual freedom, or you're talking about the individual as distinguished from the collective and the group, these archaic concerns as far as major media, universities, think tanks are concerned become all important. Because if the individual as a reality and as a concept dies out, their ability to control this is going to be magnified to enormous degrees.
Yep, exactly. I'm glad you brought up Common Core as well. We know that after, you know, the Obama administration, after they were taking control of the federal, you know, bureaucracy, they've started to change the student privacy laws, you know, so that the government can begin to track not only their own, progress, as they call it in that case, but also from the students, of course, basically from cradle to career is a term that they used. Monitoring everything from math and reading skills to values, opinions, and attitudes. And the reason for this, why is this? Because they want to be able to dumb down the kids in the most efficient way. That's what people have to understand here, you know?
That's right. You know, here's how they think about it. Okay, we have X number of students in the United States. So, first of all, we want to know a lot about these students. We want to know how many of them go on to find this kind of job in the marketplace, that kind of job, this kind of job, and what kind of education do they get before they do that? We know the job market is shrinking, so what's going to happen? We want to know what happens to the students who leave school at whatever point and they can't find a job. What do they do? What percentage of these students are going to turn out to be rebels, anti-government, anti-establishment?
Yeah, exactly.
And what will they do about that? To what degree are such ideas contagious? And what do they add up to? So we want to know about on-campus activities. We want to know about protest demonstrations. We want complete profiles of all student groups, what their activities are, their membership lists, the whole shooting match. We have the computers, we have the space, we have the, you know, data crunching ability. We can put this through with a variety of scenarios. We can refine these scenarios, and we can now begin to see what do we have to do to control all students? What do we need to do? Given that our algorithms are showing the following picture map of all students in the U.S. Okay, we've got that now. Now what do we do about it? Because we can see, you know, it's like a military operation. Here is threat sector A, threat sector B, C, D, and E. Okay, so how significant are these threats? And what can we do to minimize them? It's an intelligence operation, infiltration, espionage, diversion, infiltration. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. If you thought the FBI's COINTELPRO program of 45, 50 years ago was significant, it was nothing. It was amateur night in Dixie compared to what these guys are up to now.
Well, exactly. Now, before I ask you a little bit more, I want to ask you a little bit more about the conference coming up here and what you're going to be speaking about there. But before we do that, another quick thing here. What do you make of, you mentioned Glenn Greenwald before, but interesting in terms of how I see it anyway, how he's also been kind of put onto the scene and his, was a First Look Media or the Intercept, as it's called online now, and the way, again, that this has been kind of directly published and encouraged by, of course, his background with you know, the Guardian and all that, but he's, you know, spoken at all the Ivy League schools. He's, you know, money that's to start up The Intercept came from the eBay founder, things like that. I'm not necessarily saying that it's all, you know, bad per se, but do you have any opinions about Glenn Greenwald, The Intercept, and his part in the Snowden WikiLeaks story?
I do. I've been thinking, I've been thinking about this for a long time, going back and forth. Because on the surface, it looks like a good plan that he has, which is controlled release of the documents, Snowden documents, to keep the story alive so that it doesn't flare up and then burn out. And yes, to some degree, I would say that's true. Although, as I said at the outset, are we really seeing the curtailing of NSA power? No. So does it really matter in the long run? And after a great deal of back and forth and thought about this, my conclusion is I want to empower information outside of the mainstream. I want to empower people who expose, dig up, research, present vital news, real news, outside of the mainstream, because I know what the mainstream looks like. I know how it operates, and it's hopeless. We're never going to get any satisfaction there. So to any degree, feeding that animal is a very bad idea. Therefore, let's say in a perfect world, what I would have wanted was a complete document dump by Snowden immediately. Now, this is presuming, of course, that he is on the up and up, which now you see the story develops another interesting turn because that consideration becomes significant at this point. Is he really who he says he is? Is he really on the up and up? Is this just one guy doing this, or is this a covert operation? But let's assume that, you know, for the moment anyway, that he's on the up and up. So he would have taken all the documents. He would have dumped them onto 50 websites. And before anybody could have stopped him, all of the files would have been exposed to the entire world. Boom.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, now there are some limiting factors there. For example, we can now be pretty sure, contrary to what the press was saying in the early days, that Snowden had, of course, not vetted these documents when he took them. I don't care whether it was 50,000 or 2 million. He was not in a position to vet them, to see what was really in them, and who could be harmed, who could be killed, what operations specifically would be derailed, what would be exposed, who would be exposed over the course of all of these documents. So then the question arises, okay, should we care? Do we care? Well, I don't know, because I don't know what he's got. I really don't know. But I can imagine that there are some documents that perhaps should not see the light of day. Maybe. Maybe. But you then have to start to think, okay, is there a way that he could have worked this so that the information in those documents themselves, first went to websites rather than to mainstream or mainstreamish reporters? And that would be where I come down on this. That's the side I come down on. The bulk of the documents should be, or should have been, released online, the way the emails that were hacked into at East Anglia the climate change emails
right.
that expose these, malice-driven lunatics in the climate science community were exposed.
Right.
Boom. You then force the press to cover the story. That's different, you see, than giving them to the press first. Because, I mean, look, The Guardian and other newspapers and so forth that Snowden has favored have had countless numbers of meetings with attorneys, their own attorneys, government attorneys, the NSA, all kinds of people behind the scenes they've been talking to. And governments have been telling them, you can release this. Okay, now that the cat is out of the bag, all right. But you can't release that. You know, and they're making deals, and all kinds of things are going on. That's not good.
No.
That's not good at all. So that's far different than releasing them online, exposing them immediately. You know, you're going to have 100,000 sites that pick it up from the first 50. And it's impossible to shut all the sites down on the Snowden affair. And then the press, the mainstream press, is forced to play second fiddle and start to pick up what has already been exposed. Now you have a different energy, a different emotion, a different feeling, a different vector. Now it's Snowden going to the people, not to the press. That's a whole different world. Again, we don't know all the ramifications and consequences if he did that, but instead he went to journalists with the idea that he would say to them, you do whatever you want with this. You vet, you release, you do, you know, I'm out of it. You just do it. That's what he did. And whether or not, you know, I think that Glenn Greenwald is a good guy, or to what degree he can be trusted, he has become entangled in all of these conferences and meetings and backdoor get-togethers and so forth, because that's what happened when the documents were released to him.
Yeah.
That's not a good idea. And as far as his relationship with Omidyar in this new venture, I really don't put much stock in that as being some incredible new alternative source of data in the press. I just really don't see it that way at all. I mean, I see Omidyar as not a reliable character whatsoever for various reasons. His involvement in the Ukraine and other things that he did in the Third World and so forth. So for him to be heading up this operation, you know, it's like any other media operation. The boss is not somebody you want to involve yourself with. You know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, as a reporter, do you really want to get involved with the publisher and the owner of the New York Times or the Washington Post or Omidyar? Hell no.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
he's Pierre Omidyar, he's the 123rd richest person in the world, you know, and hanging out with Branson and these people and stuff like that. So yeah, there, yeah, there's questions there.
I mean, it would be like Bill Gates wants to hire me to be a journalist.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself, well, there's the money, you know, right? I mean, right away, you know, 98% of other reporters are going to think of this. You know, first, man, this guy's, you know, how many billions does he have? Let me look that up, you know. Oh, he's got 80, 90, what is this, 100 billion? Wow, how much of that can I lay my hands on when I'm, you know, working with crumbs here? Okay, number two consideration, you know, how bad is he? He's really bad, man, he's really bad. Number three, what can I get away with? In other words, what can I publish that he or one of his minions is not going to censor? And what won't I be able to publish? Okay, let me balance all that out. And then, of course, I've got this little thing called my own ethics. I better look, you know, talk to that. and see what I want to do here. You know, this is the conversation that goes on. And, you know, I made my choice a long time ago, but to me, if you can't run a one-man or one-woman operation, basically, you shouldn't be doing this kind of work at all. But, you know, it's what can I get away with? What can I get away with? When will the axe fall? Yeah, I'm working for Bill Gates, and I really want to write an expose about vaccines. How far will that go?
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, I mean, from a reporter's point of view, all of these things begin to, you know, affect you. Whereas, oh, look, I just went to this website, and here's whatever it was, 20,000 emails from East Anglia with climate scientists talking to each other about how they can lie, cheat, steal, and carve up the data on climate change to make it look good. And now we know. Now the press is going to have to cover that. Sure, they're going to lie about it, but they're going to have to cover it, and they're going to have to play second fiddle. To me, that's far better. And so that's the way I would like to have seen this play out. But it didn't. So now we have, speaking of the narrative that you brought up earlier and that we talked about, here's another aspect of the narrative. Is Glenn Wall the hero? Or Glenn Greenwald the hero or a villain? Let's talk about that for a long time, right? It still diverts our attention away from the main event.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the other data dump there, it makes it open source in terms of the climate gate. You know, more people can dig into it instead of it, you know, releasing it in piecemeal and everything else. It's let's pick that up after the break, John, and continue and carry on. I want to ask you more about the tie-in actually between the surveillance state and political correctness, kind of where this is leading and where the efficiency of this and the ramp up of this as well is very important stuff here. But before we end, though, I want to, of course, give up some of the websites to your work and everything. I want you to mention some of your products you have available for people on your website as well. But tell us quickly a little bit about some of the things you plan to talk about on the at the conference here in June, San Mateo, 28th, 29th. You'll be there with a lot of other good speakers as well, John. What will you be addressing there?
Secret Space Program Conference. I'm going to talk about mind control. I'm going to talk about outer space, inner space. I'm going to talk about some of my conversations over the years with people inside the space program, U.S. space program. And I'm going to go on from there to try to give a different context to this whole issue as to what is going on with this program vis-a-vis the population of Earth? How does this tie into mind control? How does it tie into advanced energy systems about which we know nothing that could revolutionize the future of the planet were they released for public consumption? There's a great deal that is tied up in the space program, the black space program behind the scenes, of which the public, most people, are completely unaware. And uncovering this information, I believe, is absolutely vital to understanding how reality is being created for us here on planet Earth and what we can do about it. And what kind of mind control is it when elites create reality for everybody else? There's a real tie-in here between the human mind and outer space. It's been the subject of, you know, massive literature for many, many, many years. What is going on? What is the psychology behind all of that? Not just because it's academically interesting to discuss it, but because I believe that it's absolutely vital to our freedom, to uncovering our deeper potential as individuals, and understanding what we can really do to upset the apple cart and make a future that's going to be far different from what the elites have in store for us. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch about what I'll be discussing.
All right, very good. So don't miss that. John Rappaport will be there speaking together with, well, we have Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, Joseph P. Farrell, of course, Richard Doland, Michael Schratt, Robert Morningstar, and Mark McCandless, the majority of people that we've already spoken to. And the other ones will be coming up on the program here as well to get a little a little idea here of what you can expect if you get there. But and I'll be hosting the conference as well, by the way, so that'll be a lot of fun for me. But the website where you can go is secretspaceprogram.org for tickets and more information and everything else that you need to know about dates and such. And of course, I want to mention the members. Please check out the ticket discount that we have for you guys as well over at redicemembers.com. Give us your website, John, and give us tell us what more you have on offer there for our audience.
Yes, my website is nomorefakenews.com. I've been publishing there after working as a reporter for a number of years. I decided to take my work, you know, directly to people rather than go through all kinds of outlets for reasons that should be apparent by now. nomorefakenews.com. And aside from writing stories just about every day, and you can sign up for my free email list, I have three collections there: The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. These are mega collections of information, and they are directed specifically at the whole idea of freedom, power of the individual, mind control, what is the hidden potential that exists in all of us, and how we can achieve it, not just theoretically or intellectually, but for real. That's been the underlying thrust of my work for the last 30 years, and finally, in the last few years, realized in these three collections, which you can read all about there at No More Fake News.
All right, very good. NoMoreFakeNews.com. Check out the Matrix series. We'll have the links up on RedIceCreations.com as well to John's work and website there. All right, very good. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us, John, and we'll be back shortly.
Rocks!
Please join us in the next segment as we proceed with John Rappaport, as we put surveillance into the agenda of self-censorship, political correctness, the matrix of control, and inhibiting the individual and the creative spirit. We discuss how humor is now being censored, kids are getting arrested for Facebook posts, tweets, and t-shirts. We also go into the entire Donald Sterling debacle and show how these are censorship sting operations aimed at the media consumer in order to train them in self-censorship. Remember, no one questioned how this call actually was recorded. We also discuss Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept. Then we go deeper into the war on human nature. We discuss Frank Boas, the Frankfurt School, Herbert Marcuse, repressive tolerance, and the spell that has been cast on people and culture. We continue for another hour and a half with John Rappaport. Please tune in to the second segment for a very interesting and important continuation. We do have a members section where you can hear the rest. If you're not yet a member, subscribe, check it out. It's quick and easy. You'll get full access to our archives going back to 2006. Tons of shows now, over 800, approaching 900 now, I think, on a lot of different topics. I'm sure you can find something that'll be enticing and sparking your interest. We, of course, have a lot more new stuff coming up as well. Next is Felice Vinci and Bill Mullen on the Baltic origins of Homer's epic tales. Also Dave McGowan, David Matheson, Carol Rosen, Gregory Sams, and many more. But after this, we have Radio 314 with Atti Skytte from South Africa. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more John Rappaport at redicememembers.com.